This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, delivering specialty foods and ingredients right to your restaurant, bakery, and bar. Learn more at parisgourmet.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you four stories about lost and found culinary treasures.
We are searching for what will be lost, and we're trying to rejuvenate it.
What we try to do is collect these sourdoughs that contribute to the biodiversity of sourdough in order to store them, to document them, and be able to preserve them for the future.
It's bringing back the history and just being part of that time that just, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it.
When fame comes late, I'm sure it's just as sweet as when it comes earlier.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building and growing consumer brands. When we launched a line of fresh sauces, I knew we were jumping into something crazy. Haven's Kitchen is a cooking school, cafe, and event space. A product that people buy in grocery stores is an entirely new business, and I had a lot to learn. So in my efforts to get myself educated, I started meeting everyone I know and respect who could advise me on production and distribution, sales and legal, PR, and social media. Then I started having those conversations here as a podcast so that other entrepreneurs can learn from them as well. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen Sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Becca Parrish, founder and CEO of Becca, the creative communications agency behind brands such as Ralph Lauren's The Polo Bar, Eric Repair's Le Bernardin, The Queen Chefs of King, Ignacio Matos's Estella, I could keep going, Casa, how do we pronounce
Dragones.
It? Dragones Tequila, Jay-Z's Champagne, and the most recent star of Netflix Chef's Table, Mashama Bailey of The Grey, among, I feel like, so many others. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, you're, almost 15 years this December. So
it's
crazy.
Awesome. I'm so psyched to speak to you, Becca. Thank you so much for coming. I often sort of joke that even if people weren't listening to this podcast, I could kind of use it as like a ruse to like bring in experts and get like all sorts of free advice. And you were definitely like someone I want some free advice from.
Okay,
so happy for you listeners, but also psyched for myself in this case. So I always start a little bit with, you know, what you were like as a kid, what you wanted to be. Obviously, you probably didn't know you wanted to go into PR slash communications.
No, absolutely not. In fact, quite the opposite. And so, that I felt like I was a storyteller and always liked to write, even as a child. I wanted to be an attorney, weirdly. Yeah. I had read To Kill a Mockingbird.
Atticus Finch.
That's right. And I thought he was just an incredible person. And but my father like was so not into that. He talked me out of law school.
Really? Interesting. So you wanted to be attorney, not just like from being little, but like kind of all the way through school.
Yeah. And what I was going to do for graduate school.
Oh, wow.
But I always loved telling stories and I always liked asking questions.
First, why did he talk you out of it?
Just curious. It's funny. I should ask him. And we have talked about it through the years. He was kind of a hippie, frankly.
Yeah, I was going to say, was he like
hippies?
A creative guy?
Yeah, that's a sidebar. But my parents had a trapeze act in the only collegiate circus at the time. So they
definitely going to talk about that.
Trapeze. Yeah. I have some amazing videos and photos. But I think he thought they were evil. And I really thought of, certainly using Atticus Finch as an example, but they were champions of people.
Right.
And I have found that I really am more comfortable doing what you're doing right now and asking people questions and championing people that I believe in and causes that I believe in versus, you know, kind of talking about myself. So that was kind of where it began. And I think loving to tell stories and loving to write, that also began at a young age, as did the love of food.
Right. So were you a food person when you were little?
I was. And I grew up in Pensacola, Florida, Northwest Florida.
And were your parents in a trapeze act through your whole childhood?
No, or? They gave it up. They gave it up. My dad's joke is once he fell on my mom on the net, then they had to get married. Aww. So there it was.
It's very romantic.
Yes, it is. It is. But we had a big garden in our backyard in Florida and grew all sorts of vegetables and potatoes and flowers. And I like to say, though, my God, the amount of squash and zucchini.
Yep.
I ate like year round. It was frozen.
Yeah.
We would pickle everything. We had pickled green beans. And I, even in, at the, you know, hands of someone like Ignacio Matas or anyone, I can't, a zucchini just does nothing for me.
That's how I feel about crackling oat bran.
Yeah.
It's a very different story, but I OD'd one night like studying for exams. And
forget it.
I was not okay. you know, those boxes of cereal that are like bigger than your like upper torso.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, never.
It's just not
okra.
The thing.
It's not because I overdid it.
Okra.
I know.
I still like it.
I feel bad.
I know.
Saying it.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I do feel bad too sometimes, but I don't care. I ate and you know more
a
than
lot
a
of
modest
zucchini.
Sufficiency. Yes.
Yes.
But so childhood was pretty. You know, I grew up on the coast of Florida, and we had lots of Appalachian coast. Oysters. We had tons of huge Gulf shrimp, fried mullet with cheese grits, and homemade bread and butter pickles were my that was my favorite meal.
So you ate well as a kid.
I ate very well.
And it doesn't sound like you ate a lot of sort of industrial food complex foods.
Not at all.
Right.
You know, although, you know, like school lunches, I had a Miss Debbie. I mean, I was obsessed with all the Miss Debbie flavors. I had one of those in those little packaged sweets. I had one every single day.
Yeah.
And I had Chef Boyardee sometimes, but there was a lot of fresh food in my house, and I did sort of take it for granted. And it's funny now to represent restaurants, you know, for coming on 20 years, because my company's just 15 years old. You know, I think about what a thrill it was to go to restaurants.
Yeah.
And it was like occasionally we would go to this Chinese restaurant, and occasionally we would go to this Italian restaurant, and it would be on a Friday night, and I have an older brother and sister, all of whom now live in New York City, not my parents, but... I always loved that romance of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember telling my dad, I was like, can you imagine like being on a date? Like, he's like, well, no, what do you mean? What's wrong with right here?
Be
where your feet are.
Right.
Anyway.
So did you move straight to New York after school or?
No.
And you had already decided you weren't going to go to law school. So were you then sort of like, I like to write, so I'll be a journalist?
Yes,
that
was my plan.
That was the plan.
And I got my master's in journalism from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Great.
Which was a great school.
Mm-hmm.
That's another sidebar. I mean, kind of a tough time, you know. It was the toughest academic program I'd ever been in.
Yeah.
I went to Florida State undergrad, which was great, but, you know, it was like the number one party school.
Right.
Every year I was there. I did my part. But UNC was very intense, and it was very focused, the journalism program. I mean, I think what I've heard about, like, Northwestern's program or Columbia's program, which really I didn't even know about.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't visit New York City until I was in my early 20s when I met someone in graduate school who was from Wayne, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And we came to visit her friend on the Upper West Side, and I literally, it was like instantaneous deep love. Like, I had never felt so home. Like I fit in ever, because I didn't feel like I fit in the South. And thankfully I had weirdo, you know, progressive parents who built a clay tennis court in the backyard and we did not go to church. And that was very weird.
Yeah.
And I would go to Bible school with some of my friends just as to see what it was about.
Right.
You know,
I'm kind of like, I'm getting such a good visual of your childhood right
okay,
now.
Good.
It's like, I'm feeling like I'm reading a memoir.
Oh,
it's
right.
really,
that's good.
Very painted visually.
Yeah.
So you thought you were going to be a journalist.
I
did. Went to UNC.
I did.
And then how did you...
Well, then I got a fellowship at the St. Petersburg Media Studies.
Right.
What's it called? Brain.
I don't know. But you were saying something about Chapel Hill, and I think I interrupted you.
The Poynter Institute for Media Studies in St. Petersburg, Florida.
I would definitely not be able
great.
To help you out with that one. But the program was focused more on...
On sort of... like law.
Like,
I remember us studying, you know, what if there was a porta potty called Here's Johnny.
Uh-huh.
And it was sort of, you know, what is a public figure?
Right.
And less so on being in the field reporting.
Right. Got it.
Very academic.
Got it.
Like my I got a minor in women's studies, and I wrote about women in North Carolina politics.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't...
You weren't boots on the ground,
no,
on the beat.
Not
wanting,
at all.
Right,
not
got
at
it.
All.
And you wanted a little more of that.
I did.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was great, and Chapel Hill's fantastic, but it didn't... I didn't feel like I was out meeting a bunch of people and reporting.
Right, right.
At the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, I remember a young reporter from the New York Times came and spoke to us and talked about like keeping the bar high, mm-hmm, and, you know, setting your standards high and sort of the difference in not advertising, but, you know, church and state and
yeah,
the importance of keeping your sources private and all of that about setting the bar high. And that stuck with me very much. But then I got my first job was as a newspaper reporter in Montgomery, Alabama at the Montgomery Advertiser, which was... in the capital of Alabama.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because I was from not far from there. My house was 5 miles from the Alabama border.
Right.
But I hadn't met that type of, it was a different, because I
different type of Southerner.
Different type of Southern, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was very, I mean, the disparity between very wealthy, mm-hmm, people and then poverty, just like street to street.
Yeah.
And I'd met someone at Poynter who was from Marblehead, Massachusetts, and was fascinated by the South. And actually, Montgomery has a vibrant cultural scene, interestingly. Mm-hmm. There's a Shakespeare Arts Festival there.
Mm-hmm.
I know Agnes Gunn, mm-hmm, has just built this lynching museum, huh, that is very powerful. I cannot, yeah, remember the name of the architect that built it, but that's recent. And he was just enamored on the cop beat. I mean, he was just having quite a time. And then I was a features reporter, which,
okay,
at most places you have to build to that. But for,
right,
some reason at this, and there was a lot of like writing about horse shampoo,
uh-huh,
for women using horse shampoo.
Yep.
I wrote about the first deaf Miss Alabama. I cannot remember her name.
Right.
The big story, my big break was when my editor, I came into the paper and she said, I just read, she would always subscribe to the little community papers.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I just read this story and it seems weird and you should go down to Tallahassee, Alabama, and report on it because it was like these two friends had been arrested for the murder of another friend.
Uh-huh.
So I get in my car. And you think about it, there's no phones. I mean, it's, just,
right,
it's hard to,
yeah,
imagine,
totally,
isn't it? And I drive. It's like 50 minutes. And I go to the high school where the girl went.
Uh-huh.
And the principal was just like, it's just such a shame. You know, it's just so ridiculous. These sides of the river, what side of the river you were born on, side you fight for. And, you know, and the weird thing is, the principal is telling me, is her brother was shot in a drive-by.
Oh my
God. A drive-by shooting, like,
right,
a few years ago. And I was like, well, who was charging that? And he's like, no one was charged. And so he's like, I can take you to see the mother if you want to. And now, meanwhile, I'm 24,
right,
years old.
Right.
I don't know what I'm doing. I can't check in with my editor. I mean, I guess I could have used his phone,
right,
at the school, but I'm just like, yes, let's go. And ended up, we went to the woman's house and ended up this huge story for the paper. I was on the front page of the Montgomery Advertiser. I was subpoenaed to appear in court, which was a huge deal.
Right.
So, which involved all the publisher and the managing editor,
right,
and everyone. It was a big deal at the time, and to me. But that was really exciting.
Yeah, I would imagine. So why did you not stay in
because
journalism?
Because I visited New York City,
and that was
and.
The end of
really
that.
Was like, I want to put in the time to be a New York Times reporter, but I'm impatient. I'm,
right,
terribly impatient.
Right.
And I didn't feel like I had enough time.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you came here.
So
you
I
left
came here.
Being sort of like, I mean, this star on the beat, wonderkind,
I know, it's
in Alabama.
And I was there not even that much time.
And then you show up in Manhattan.
Yeah.
I feel like you're like that girl and you're,
yeah,
like looking around and you take off your hat and you throw it in the air. And
that sounds amazing. I wish it were like that.
And
it wasn't though. But, I mean, there was a interlude in, mm-hmm, Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
Where I wanted to get out of Montgomery. It was too much the same of Pensacola. I mean, it was just,
right,
I'd done this. I wanted,
yep,
to you know, go north. And so Atlanta, I was reading the classified as one did in, mm-hmm, 1995 or whenever it was. And there was a job for a communications manager for a rechargeable battery recycling corporation.
Okay.
And I'm talking so much about my dad. He'll be thrilled. my dad was very ahead of his time in terms of like sunscreen, seatbelts,
right.
Recycling.
Kombucha, probably.
Kombucha, yeah. He was just there. So I was very much focused on the environment. He gave me like Silent Spring when I graduated from college.
Right.
So I was interested in this rechargeables, but he's like, you're never going to get that job. That's like a job for, you know, I don't mm-hmm. know. That's like a 30-year-old's job. So I applied. I get the job.
Uh-huh.
And that, the spokesperson for the rechargeable, RBRC was the name of it, was Richard Karn, who was on the hottest TV show at the time called Home Improvement.
Okay.
He was like the handyman.
Sure. Yep.
Really nice guy.
Yep.
His contract required him to have first-class travel and go to New York to do PSAs and these uh-huh. commercials with the big advertising agency, uh-huh. which was Gray.
Right.
And I, as a communications manager, got to accompany him.
Oh, my gosh.
So I like went right. on a jet, obviously, for the first time in my life.
Right.
I ate at La Bernardine.
Right.
I ate at Le Cirque.
Aww.
I had my first tasting menu at Gramercy Tavern where Tom Colicchio was cooking. And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So
the world literally
yes.
opened up. Yep.
So the woman who was our contact at the Gray said, I'm not the Gray, at Gray
right.
Communications, said, I'm going to start my own PR firm. And would you
got it.
come to New York? And I was like, hell yeah. If you will pay me to come, pay me to move,
I will come.
So she did. And her name was Dorothy Crenshaw. She still runs an agency here. She
That's
split
amazing.
From her partner at the time. But so I was like the 11th employee, and my 4 years there, we got to like 60 employees and opened an office in Connecticut. But during my time there, one of the first clients I pitched was Starbucks with her.
Wow.
And we got it.
Wow.
And this was 1996, and I had to go to Seattle and like train to be a barista.
Uh-huh.
We opened the first Starbucks in Harlem.
Wow.
And Howard Schultz was very involved, and Magic Johnson was there. He was
right.
the spokesperson. And that was really cool.
And so you were now hooked.
And I was hooked. And I remember, this is so fun to think about now because we do so much of this now. But
right.
I was like, my mother cannot have any dessert without a cup of coffee. And then you sort of take on these habits. So I was sort of that way too. And so we're talking about coffee. And I was like, we should pair. And I'd been to Gramercy Tavern.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, why don't we get some of these pastry chefs and pair coffee with desserts?
Right, right.
So Claudia Fleming.
Uh-huh.
I asked her.
Who was the pastry chef at
Gramercy Tavern at
right?
the time, right? And so we did this whole tasting. I invited some other people. I don't remember. I only remember Claudia. But we did this whole
for the
pairing
opening
event
of Starbucks?
For a different Starbucks.
Right,
one
right.
of the openings.
Okay.
But it was not one in
right.
the Harlem. It was one downtown. But that's so
like
funny
pre-Sweet
now.
Like Pre-Sweet Green,
yeah.
you know, in
right.
a way.
Well, yeah.
yeah.
And like collaborations. Hello,
right.
you know.
Exactly.
Is that 23 years ago?
Yeah.
Wait, how is that possible? No, 22 years ago. Okay. Whatever, a long hell.
You know,
time ago.
What goes around comes around.
Yeah, right.
Okay, we're going to take a little break, and now we're going to talk about all sorts of fun PR and branding and communications
Sweet.
Stuff.
This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, a leading specialty food importer and distributor servicing the New York tri-state area and beyond from coast to coast. I'm Jordan Werner Berry, the host of Modernist Breadcrumbs here on HRN. When it comes to freshly baked artisan bread, it's key to pair it with butter that's made with the same amount of care and attention. And you don't have to go all the way to France to find truly amazing butter. Bourmont 83% is an American butter made using traditional French methods. It's produced by a dairy cooperative in New England, and as a Vermont native, I love that this delicious butter is made locally by family farms. Bourmont 83% is great for cooking, baking, and serving on your table with fresh breads and artisan cheeses. It's proudly distributed by Paris Gourmet to restaurants and grocery stores around the tri-state area. Learn more about Paris Gourmet and all of their gourmet savory foods and pastry ingredients at parisgourmet.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Jimmy Carboni, and I'm the host of Beer Sessions Radio here on HRN. My show is an audio ale salon celebrating the world of craft beer, cider, food, and more. Through discussions with industry insiders and knowledgeable beer fans, my friends and I explore every aspect of the brewer's craft, from grains to pint glass and tasting to toasting. You can find Beer Sessions Radio wherever you listen to podcasts, and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm back with Becca Parrish, founder and CEO of Becca, the, I would say, rock star communications agency. So now getting down to brass tacks. I guess I've heard a lot of times, and I've heard it when I opened Havens, and I've heard it when we launched the sauces at Whole Foods. You really only get one chance mm-hmm. to make a first impression, or you really only get one launch. Mm-hmm. And I guess my first question for you is, you know, whether it's a product or a place, mm-hmm. Are there sort of any secrets to a great launch right. of anything?
Yeah. I think if you have the time, or you have to make the time to do the homework and to ask the, not, they shouldn't be hard questions, but maybe they are. I mean, obviously we're living in the time where everyone's a brand. You're a brand, right. you have your personal brand, yeah. and then you have Haven's brand. And I mean, it's kind of fascinating. And yeah. I think that you, to understand how, like I like to say, we're in the era of too muchness, where there's mm-hmm. too much email, there's too much good television. No one has time to watch, or I don't.
Yeah.
You know, too many awesome podcasts.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's true.
So how are you going to break through and find your people, find your audience? Yeah. So I think to really ask the questions, who am I? What do I stand for? What are my values? And I use me as a, you know, meaning that can be your a brand, a place, sure. a person, a product. And what are you going to put out in the world?
Right.
And that has to be crystal clear. And it has to take advantage of who you are and what makes you different.
Yeah, I think that's part of, you know, I think people who've listened to me on the podcast have probably heard me say this a number of times, but I feel like that's almost, we know at Havens, like we know who we are and we know what our mission is, and I feel like we have a pretty good idea of what we put out into the world. I think it's very hard for us, for some reason, almost every Instagram post, you know, we struggle with what are we trying to say? Like who, what do we want this to convey?
Yeah.
You know, like it's hard to have something and I think we have so many different things going on and mm-hmm. so many different facets. My guess is that most people take Havens out of it for a second. Mm-hmm. I think most people with places or with products feel like I'm clean ingredients. I also have a star chef. I'm also, the design is beautiful. Like you could name 15 things. Mm-hmm. I think the hard part for a lot of founders is figuring out.
What are the three or four?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How to narrow it down.
Yeah.
And then how to kind of speak about those things. Because we all want to say everything that's good and different about us. Because yeah. pretty much every founder thinks that they have completely mm-hmm. invented something that's never existed yeah. before. Even though it's another restaurant or mm-hmm. it's another mm-hmm. sauce, you mm-hmm. know. So do you, how do you help people kind of honing in on that
to
stuff?
To distill.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think to break it down to being, as simple as asking really thoughtful questions and listening. I mean, that's what's been exciting for me going back to who I thought I was going to be,
a little journalist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That really it still happens in meetings. It's just asking thoughtful questions. And I think there's not enough of that. I think everything's moving too fast and people, I think there's a difference between sort of ambition and which everyone has and, oh, I'm going to, you know, market myself and put this forward. And then there's just being real. And I mm-hmm. feel like I have been honored to have a good nose for that real.
Yep.
And real people and real stories. And then it's so easy
yeah.
to champion those people.
Yeah, it's true. If you think about the brands and the chefs and the restaurants you represent, they have such a clear sort of Jungian archetype.
Hmm.
You know, they have such a clear identity. Mm-hmm. You would not mistake Le Bernardin for any other restaurant.
Right. It's
you
true.
Know, you just wouldn't.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool and probably, yeah, you've got a good picker yeah. mm-hmm. is the expression, I guess.
Oh,
I don't know. So aside from the launch, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of follow-up question to that
yeah.
is I almost feel like the launch is the easy part in
right.
a way.
Yeah.
Because it's new and it's shiny and people want something to write about.
Yeah.
How do you help brands and restaurants stay relevant mm-hmm. when there isn't necessarily a news
Sure.
Story.
Well, first of all, you have to, you know, going back to identifying, like, what's your DNA, mm-hmm. what you're standing for. Then, I mean, and then it comes to being creative. Like, what are you putting out in the world, or what? How are you evolving? I mean, to mm-hmm. your point about there is one chance to be new. I think that is true, but you know, brands and people do evolve mm-hmm. and they change. And so then I think, is there something that you can own that's particular to you? Is there some holiday that's resonant to you or your right. family? Is there some place that you go that only you know about? Is there some weird right. ingredient that you just are hot for and you can make this one particular thing based on this holiday? So it's right. Kind of owning who you are and then finding ways to you know, create news, but that's real. That's
right.
That's true.
Right. That makes sense. I feel like I saw something recently, like an Estella, he does something with a salad or he does something.
Well, I was thinking of Shama Bailey at The Gray, uh-huh. who is on the new season of Netflix and is just phenomenal. And even with that, I think like my whole thinking when I first met with Jono Morsano and Shama, their business partners, it was just like, this is more than a restaurant, mm-hmm. you know, it's more than a restaurant.
Yeah.
I mean, and when you, that kind of goes to, I was trying to think of a more modern way of an elevator pitch, but just the idea that you can tell your story in 2 minutes or 3 short sentences, which mm-hmm. I think is key, especially
yeah,
in this
that I'm
era
like,
of
I'm so long-winded,
short attention
hard.
Spans.
Yep.
You really, but it's also useful. That exercise is useful not only for you to be able to do. It's essential for you to be able to do, but also for your team.
Yeah.
For any partners you're trying to do brand collabs. Well, who are we? Well, here you go.
Right.
For anyone on the floor, for you know, this
yep.
working at the restaurant.
Absolutely.
Everyone has to have that elevator pitch. Let's brainstorm to come up with a new modern name for that.
I've heard like a one-page version, a one-paragraph version, and like a one-sentence version.
I think you life just, is about you leave everyone wanting more. Say right. less.
Say
get
less.
Out quick, you know?
Yeah.
Ask.
So 2 sentences.
Yes, 2 to 3.
2 to 3. So I feel like you've kind of answered this a little bit already, but most of the people, I think, you know, DM me if I'm wrong, but I think, you know, we have several thousands of downloads on this podcast, and I'm still trying to figure out who you all are.
Who are you?
Who are you and what are you doing? But my guess is that the majority of them are not in a position right now to hire mm-hmm. PR.
Yeah.
So for the quick and dirty mm-hmm. DIY crew out there,
yeah.
You've already said, take the time to sit down with your team mm-hmm. and figure out
what
who you are,
for, what's your
what
of
you
view.
Stand for, mm-hmm. what your point of view is, craft it into a 2 or 3 sentence thing. Probably just have some like highlighted words in there mm-hmm. so that everyone can kind of have these digestible, repeatable sort of things about you.
Mm-hmm.
But what else would you advise to a founder or a team who can't quite afford the
sure.
PR, but some hacks?
Sure. I would say too, to be unafraid to be different, you
right.
know? That's going to get people's, don't,
I know.
You know, that's going to get someone's attention. I always yeah. tell my team from day one, I was like, if you use any weirdo PR jargon or send an email to a client as a result of, no yeah. one wants to hear that. Just be real.
Yeah.
Have a personality.
Yep.
And that goes for anyone that's trying to get someone's attention.
Yeah. That's actually, anyone who hasn't listened, Catherine Woodruff was, she's the head of communications for Bonza Pasta. And mm-hmm. she was on last week, I guess. And she was, her sort of main gist was, you know, act like a person, not like a brand.
Yes.
And it's funny because I think in a way we've tried, you know, I feel like we need to polish it up a little bit on mm-hmm. our end. Like I think Havens is almost
too much. Like
too much. Hmm. Yeah. Like I don't think we quite, our logo looks different in
yeah.
every place. And like the sound bites we use are kind of different and no one knows that this is connected to the, you know, like we're
yeah.
kind of a little bit all over the place. So I feel like a little bit, we need to like get a little bit more polished up,
mm-hmm.
but the ones that kind of come out of the gate and they've got it all figured out and they don't actually have a true identity, it kind of, you start to see them crack
mm-hmm.
a little bit after a year or two, you know, you start to see them really struggling with like, what do they stand for?
Mm-hmm.
What do these products all have in, you know, in common? Are they just sort of following, you know, in restaurant world, it might be sort of like, let's do a roast cauliflower.
Right.
But in brand world, you know, CPG world, it could be like, let's label this keto, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because these things, they come on and you start to feel like you're almost missing out on something that's going, you know,
that's
out
why
in the
it's
world.
Such a relief if you are really clear with
right.
your brand pillars, what you stand for, then you can ignore the noise.
Yes.
And just keep your eye on the prize,
yes.
you know?
And I will say that the prize, it comes back around. You know, even, you know, we're very analog, you know, mm-hmm. we don't have a direct to consumer thing. There's no app where you mm-hmm. can order, you know, we're still human beings as baristas. And
yeah.
I feel very, that's one of our values, right, as a company. And for a little while there, it almost seemed like we were kind of an anachronism. And now there's sort of this digital fatigue and people want a real place and they want a place that isn't prettier
sure.
on Pinterest than
yeah.
it is in real life.
For sure.
And, you know, they want human interaction. And I think that, you know, to your point, if a listener, if you're out there and you're feeling like the world is passing you by a little bit, just put your head down, have the patience, it will come back around.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And you touched on something I was going to say in terms of if you can't afford PR. I mean, people, you know, your greatest asset is yourself and you're mm-hmm. Looking at it. So I think, you know, to... In addition to sort of celebrating who you are and what you stand for and being clear about your values and what you're comfortable putting out in the world, the other idea of, you know, identifying your audience and audiences, but, mm-hmm. you know, what do they listen to?
Yeah.
Where do they go? What do they watch? And then how do I get to them? How
right.
can I be part of the conversations that I want to be a part of?
Yeah. And that's a question for you because... So let's say, you know, someone out there has a cereal company mm-hmm. and they are, they're thinking they know who their target consumer is. Mm-hmm. They can almost picture him or her, you mm-hmm. know, and they could write a little story about their life and they can figure out like where they work and mm-hmm. who they live with and
okay.
what magazines they read and what
yeah.
television shows they watch. Then what?
Well, I think this is what's been so interesting and in how quickly... the world changes, but certainly the PR marketing world. You know, I used to say, oh, no, we're not marketing, because marketing in my mind was cheesy promotion.
Well, there used to be definite, like, lines,
well, now
right?
it's all marketing.
Yes.
Really. And the power of the New York Times to, as an example, to change lives, you know, mm-hmm. for good or ill, is still incredibly relevant.
Yeah.
So you still need... traditional or whatever you want to call it.
Press.
Yeah. Media relations. But then the opportunities to do things, especially in the food lane. I mean, I feel
yep.
so lucky to be in this. Not only am I a trencher woman since forever, but, you know, technology can't disrupt
mm-hmm.
the need to sit down and have a drink and have a coffee
yep.
and break bread and have something delicious to eat. Like we, you know, I joke, but we're not robots yet.
No, I know.
So that's advantageous. And I think
yes.
a lot of people want to get in on that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, it makes people happy. I mean, food is profound. It's elemental. So,
yeah.
So I think those sort of brand collaborations, social is a huge piece of what we do. And I think, you know, the power of, you know, word of eye is as powerful as word of mouth these
right.
days, clearly.
Word of eye. Is
yes.
that like a
That's like
term?
A thing, I guess.
It means just like
yeah.
seeing something on Instagram?
Sure. I mean, there are people that go and book trips and
yeah.
choose their restaurant. They're not reading anything. They're just going on Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that because I have this theory. And, you know, I think partly... And we'll talk a little bit more about the difference between, like, you know, a CPG and a restaurant
yeah.
in terms of PR and marketing
mm-hmm.
and all of that. But I definitely, depending on the category that you're in, so my sauces are fresh, refrigerated, it is going to be very hard for me to sell them directly to consumers. The shipping is really expensive. They need to be FedExed overnight.
Mm.
You know, I would have to build mm-hmm. out a pretty massive sort of supply chain system. And I'm not quite sure that people want to buy sauce that way. Perhaps they will eventually. But
mm-hmm.
right now, only 10% of groceries are actually bought online. Most of them are still bought in stores. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the things that are bought online are bulk items, dry goods. Obviously, you know, your toilet paper and your paper mm-hmm. towels, and a lot of times your, you know, like rice mm-hmm. and beans and sure. things like that, heavy things. Mm-hmm. But people still like to go to the market and buy produce and buy meat and hopefully buy fresh sauce. So, question, mm-hmm. long-winded way of answering, yeah. of asking. But I feel like this, there was an overpromise of digital. Mm-hmm. I feel like there was this sort of moment where everything was going to be virtual and everybody in, you know, at the restaurant was going to be, you weren't going to order from people anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. And there was this world of like, it'll cut all the costs and it'll cut all the middlemen and there'll be no more distributors and there'll be no, and everything's just going to go online. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the pendulum is starting to swing back mm-hmm. a little bit. I feel like people want analog experiences.
Definitely. And look at what we're doing. We're radio. It's like, oh,
I know. I know. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that people are a little bit flooded with the new thing that's on their Instagram feed. And I think that they kind of, at this point, have a little bit of, I've seen this influencer holding that bag of, you know, every other one of their posts now feels like an ad. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to just go and do some discovery on my own. Are you getting any sense that there's like a little bit of a return back to in real life?
Well, I don't think they are, you know, mutually exclusive. I think that they absolutely, people are craving community. I think the success of places like Create and Cultivate and The Wing and mm-hmm. Cherry Bomb and Jubilee. I was just there yesterday. WeWork for sure. I just was reading the Tyler Haney, the Outdoor Voices piece in the New Yorker. Who I adore her. And, it's interesting. All those are founded by women. Mm-hmm. But I think that sort of, you know, people want to be inspired. They want to get together. I don't know if I'm certain that the political climate has mm-hmm. affected that you just want to find your tribe and hunker down with people who you feel seen by and heard by. And then, you know, certainly with Me Too and just the need for transparency and for people to, I mean, there's good and bad there, I think. But I think that people are looking to, I mean, help people up, you know, give people opportunities and also to take people down.
Yeah.
But I think there's, you know, with every opportunity, there's inherent challenges. And I think I tell myself that, ultimately, it's good.
Yeah. And do you think launching, because you have a few products in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's mostly places.
Yeah.
And chefs.
No, more and more we're having, you know, I used to always say, oh, I can't do product. I mean, this is a decade ago. Mm-hmm. But I'd be like, oh, it's just too commercial. What's the story? You know, but then there's incredible product stories.
Yeah.
And incredible people behind them.
Yeah. And my guess is more and more people in places like mm-hmm. me that are launching products.
Right. Want to get something out of the four walls of the
restaurant. Yeah, definitely. And feel like we, you know, we have something to offer beyond the four walls and a cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you find that there's a different approach, or are the questions that you ask similar? Are they
very
does
similar.
It kind of always go to like who you are, what you stand for,
it
what
does.
Do you want to put out
really,
into the
it does.
World?
Yeah, there's I really other than the, you know, challenge of a restaurant isn't inherently a place to go and people can experience it and the product, you know, is more transactional. Mm-hmm. But no, I think that the same rules apply.
And when you see good marketing or good communications mm-hmm. or good PR, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. out there in the world, you know, what are the things that sort of like stand out to you that make it really good?
That's such a good question. I think it is consistency. It's mm-hmm. part of it. So it's very, you know, oh yeah, I saw that. I do think hitting multiple points, which goes to the idea, the time, the era of too muchness, mm-hmm. that you also, you know, you might be, get a spot on Billions. You might then see someone, an event on someone's feed. Then you might read about it on mm-hmm. Eater. And then you just have to kind of be everywhere.
Yeah.
And then you're invited to this cool collab with Converse mm-hmm. and they're on there. But the consistency of brand messaging and quality.
Right.
And then again, you know, is there, I mean, I think, you know, marketing, if you're doing a story in the LA Times, then is that have you magnified that on your social feed? It's just, right. You know.
I know. It's so funny. You know, when I published my cookbook, I was in Elle magazine, mm-hmm. and I was uncomfortable posting it on Instagram.
I know.
I look back and I'm like, what were you thinking? I just thought it looked braggy. And I didn't want to be like, thank you so much, Elle Magazine, for the shout out. You know,
well,
like,
I hope you have changed your tune.
I have changed my tune, but I feel like it was a little bit of a waste. I'm like,
well, it was,
and I don't think my publisher
talent.
Was thrilled about it, actually.
No, should have had someone pushing you.
I know.
I mean, because you can't always be your best advocate. Yeah. I mean, you can't advocate for yourself. And I realize that, you know, what we do is a luxury for a lot of people. It's also an insurance policy for a lot of people.
Yes, for sure.
But I have noted the same thing. And, you know, I when you're asking when you like a campaign or notice it, what is it? Mm-hmm. I have always admired the invisible aspect of really great marketing. Like, it is, that's why I didn't do these kinds of things that we're sitting here doing forever. I never pitched myself. Who gives...
Yeah.
Can I cuss here?
Yeah,
who gives a
definitely.
Darn? Who gives a damn?
No, you're allowed to curse.
All right,
it's
great.
Heritage
Radio. Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
but I guess sort of people do. And at this stage, I've been doing it long enough.
Yeah.
And I think that goes to your own personal growth. If I'm uncomfortable with things, I'm going to try to say yes. I mean, that's what Dory Greenspan was speaking about yesterday at Jubilee, where it was just like, you know, say yes to the things that terrify you the most.
Yes.
But really, it was...
I hope this doesn't terrify you.
Oh, it doesn't.
You.
You're okay, amazing, good. And this is super
okay,
easy and awesome and fun. But I do think that I have made myself take a page from...
Your own
younger,
playbook.
Well, no, from people that have started after me
yep.
that really are very skilled at promoting themselves.
Yes.
And I just wanted to see how it felt.
Yeah.
And I think that's... You kind of... I mean, I tell my clients, I was like, when you go on TV, just amplify yourself.
Yeah.
You have to turn the notch up 2 to 3 knots.
Yeah.
And amplify your personality. That is what television is.
Yeah.
And you just have to play that game a little bit if you want to be successful.
I got
really good advice.
I got really good advice from a yoga teacher, actually. Okay. And it wasn't about like media as much as it was about fundraising. And I just said, you know, as I've gotten older, I'm just really allergic to feeling like I'm being inauthentic in any way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually bitten me in the ass a little bit because mm-hmm. I don't feel like I have much of a personal brand. I sort of bristle at the idea. I've tried to sort of, I've gotten reluctantly kind of pulled into, I think, a sort of culture of founder fetish, which I try to really tell people it's not that much fun, honestly. Mm-hmm. It can be, mm-hmm. but there's some, you know, slogging.
For sure.
But she said something really helpful. Maybe this would be helpful for other people. She said, you don't talk to an 8-month-old the same way that you talk to an 8-year-old.
True.
And you don't talk to an 8-year-old the same way you talk to an 18-year-old. That doesn't mean that that's not all you talking.
Right. No, that's great.
It's all just different aspects of you. And my gynecologist is actually, she just... She just wrote a book.
Share a story.
You know, I mean, she just wrote a book on like being pregnant and pregnancy. Yeah. And she's like the last person to go out there and promote herself.
And
I said, like, you worked for 2 years on this thing.
Yeah.
You know your shit. Like, you are a really good doctor. And you are going to teach a lot of people some stuff that they don't know. You're helping people. Going out there and like pitching yourself and being on these things, like, you're doing the world a favor, you know? And she looked at me and she's like, do you ever listen to your own advice? Or are you just like, and I'm sitting there like on the table, you know, like staring at her, like trying to like make eye contact, and she's busy. But I do, you know, I do think that there is more of a self-promotion vibe now. It's kind of the hustle, quote unquote, or, you know, I think we're in similar age brackets and it was very much, you know, be humble, be under the radar. The only times you want to be in the paper are your birth announcement and your death announcement. That was what I heard as a kid. So going back, we have a few more minutes.
Yeah.
But I want to get back because I like the idea of the 2 to 3 sentences. But I'm also wondering if there's anything else just like on one page that people out there can do, like, should they have... bullet points? Should they have a drawing of some sort? Like, should they try to figure out who, you know, if they were a vegetable, what would they be? Or if they were a character from a book, what would they be? Like, are there any exercises that they can do to kind of...
Now, are we talking about that they're actually going to pitch themselves? They're going to try to...
I mean, I think they're going to have... They're going to maybe... Even if they don't go so far as to try to pitch themselves, mm-hmm. although I think everyone should, you know, figure out your local paper, look at other brands out there and see who's written about them and then write them.
Well, I just think we're in, it's such a powerful time of DMing. I mean, really, you can reach anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, that goes for dating. You know, people don't share phone numbers.
I've like tried to stalk some. Like,
you've DM'd someone and pitched them?
I haven't DM'd them. I've LinkedIn messaged them and they have not responded.
I think, well, I think that, I mean, I think it's hard. And I think, like, I'm terrible on LinkedIn. Like, I rarely check it. You know, I need to turn on those notifications so I go on there to check it. But I think it's changing. I think they're making it more sort of accessible. But I think I mean, I like to say, you know, I tell my team, if you're trying to get someone's attention, you're adding to their already busy day. So mm-hmm. it better be short and sweet and smart and timely and have a personality if you expect a response. And it's not like, I moved to the city, I didn't know a soul.
Right.
You know, I paid attention, I read, and I would reach out to people that I liked their writing. I liked what they did, and this was all, you know, media, that was it at the time. But, you know, people want their work to be acknowledged. That's human nature.
Yep.
So do your homework.
Right.
Read what they've written.
And I mean, I've heard this too. Like, if someone writes on architecture, do not pitch them a story about your peanut butter.
That's just so basic.
But you know what? We don't know how it works. We literally...
Really?
Well, because you don't know how anything works until you do it, right?
Yeah.
People will call us and be like, can I have an event on your roof? And we'll be like, we don't have a roof. You know, I mean, you know, like, they just don't know. They're like, oh, I read somewhere.
Lazy.
I think I thought, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't, but there are reporters have lanes, mm-hmm. presumably, right? And
for sure.
Some do roundups.
They have interests. I mean, they're humans.
They have interests.
So pay attention. But also you can, I mean, I like the idea that people just DM someone they want to date if they want to, and then they'll check you out. Or you share your handle versus a number, because that's a way to really communicate.
Yeah.
I mean, so you could reach anyone.
Yeah.
Any product, any person, someone is paying attention to those DMs. And so I think that's incredibly liberating.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Slide into someone's DMs.
Totally.
And when you do that, okay, best advice, make it short.
Short and
should
sweet.
You have an actual
lose the,
pitch
no
figured
exclamation
out?
Marks. I'm a real anti-exclamation mark. No.
No.
No, be serious, be cool, be short and sweet, and be out.
Okay.
Again, leave people wanting more. It's
and
very
should you just
basic.
Say, you know, hi, we launched this sauce company, we think it...
I would spice that language
okay,
up a bit.
Okay, so...
I'd be like, what up? No.
yo.
This, you know... I mean, just make it sound exciting. I mean, a launch? Never use the word launch. That's
okay.
Saved for missiles.
Okay.
New York Times agrees.
Never use the word launch,
no.
guys.
I mean, you know, that's my personal.
No, favorite. I love
that's
it.
The journalist in me.
It's like activate.
Yeah. I think also you're trying to facilitate. You're trying to turn them on to something they don't know about, which is going to be good for them.
Yeah.
You know, and historically, I would always share things of people writers or people that I thought were cool, just because I thought it was cool, not because it was a client.
Right.
So you could be a resource to them, and you're going to tell them something. I also frequently take off the obligation of a response.
Yes.
It's like, I'm not expecting you to get back to me on this. I just want you to know about this.
Right. And there is something to be said for not necessarily, you know, it's almost like you're planting seeds, and you know, for every, you know, sometimes they don't grow for a while, but just kind of reaching out and saying, hi, this thing exists, and hi, I really like your work, and I, you know, I'd be
totally
happy to talk sometime or have some coffee. One other question about that is that I feel like, because we don't have national distribution, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. it's been very hard. You know, we've been in a few national publications, and they need available at boom.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to send them to my website because I actually don't like sending sauce from Haven's Kitchen. So, do you, for restaurants that are in particular areas, mm-hmm. do you ever find it challenging to get sort of national press?
I think you
for
have
them?
To identify or plug into if there are national trends happening,
right?
That you
so maybe
that are
bigger
relevant.
Than your product,
exactly.
Yep, got it.
And it could be ingredient based. It could,
and you're just a part of that larger story.
And understand, but guess what? Those roundups are relevant.
Yeah,
and they're relevant for SEO searches. They're you know, they matter. I mean, to be in those lists, I think clients for a while are like, oh, I don't want to be on that list. And now I'm like, okay, bring on the list.
Right.
Because, and that's an exciting part of what we do too, is the analytics is there. It used to be like, you can't measure buzz and you can't, but you can measure likes.
Yeah.
And you can measure, you know, whether you see more reservations after you get a huge feature and, you know, Bon Appetit or something.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Yeah. So when you, couple last questions. Mm-hmm. One is, what do you think that brands or restaurants get wrong that you wish you could just sort of make a banner and say, hey, everybody, do not do this?
Or bad lighting?
Bad
lighting. No, I'm really a stickler for lighting. Wow. And you mean from a marketing perspective?
From their communications strategy perspective or their marketing.
But this is my personal thing. I don't like when people are a little too self-serious and there's no way to engage not life isn't light and there's not levity and everything, but I think I'm not saying it's not effective,
right,
to really drill down, this is who we are, you know, but I find a little heavy-handed marketing tiresome.
Yeah.
And not as real or and authentic, you know? So I think just be, if you're great, and this is what I love about the city, New Yorkers will find greatness. Yeah. They will find it.
I can tell you from experience with Havens, people have said, how'd you get the press? I mean, because we've gotten really good press. And it's all been from people who've come there.
A genuine response.
Genuine response. I'm so grateful, so blessed for it. You know?
It's so true, Allie, and that's tremendous. And that's really the best. I mean, then... In the ideal world, you would have someone who's kind of championing you and making some of those things that you just don't have time to get to happen.
No, I know.
But I do think there is a lack of the connection if you wanted it to be that, but you also have a very busy life. But the connection between you and Havens, I don't think people just don't know that.
Yes.
You know, they don't.
Yeah.
Most people don't.
No,
unless you're in the, you know, sort of West Village circle and you hang out, you know.
Exactly. And I don't know. I think my ambivalence shines through a little bit.
Yeah.
So we're working on it. Last question.
Mm-hmm.
What's the most fun you've had? I mean, I'm sure you've had a lot of fun, but is there
a
moment?
That's such a good question.
Like, I mean,
I had a moment. This will tie it all back to my upbringing, which we started with weirdly. I've never talked so much about my childhood.
I have that effect on people.
I know, it's so funny.
Yeah, it's weird.
So, when I was in eighth grade, or I don't know, seventh or eighth grade, and I wanted a polo shirt so badly. Uh-huh. And I was like, are you kidding? I'm not paying whatever for the polo shirt. But all the like cool kids had the polo shirts at camp. And not where, in Pensacola, Florida. I went to camp in North Carolina. And then cut to how many years later, and I have been, you know, really involved with Ralph Lauren and the opening of the Polo Bar. And it's been such an honor.
Yeah.
And I say, like, as an American, like, I want that brand to survive.
Yes.
Because it's iconic and he's amazing.
Yep.
He is an exceptionally wonderful person who has people who've worked with him for years and years
and
years. Like
I've
30
heard.
Years, everyone.
Yeah.
And here are these tastings that I have got, you know, been able to sit beside him and learn from him and make him laugh and make silly jokes and really get into food and his personal history with food.
Yeah.
And what an honor.
Yeah.
You know, so if you had told my little 11-year-old self that you'd be sitting beside Ralph Lauren
next to Ralph,
you know, for many, many tastings, I wouldn't have been able to believe it. So that's been a thrill.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
And that's great. And that's how like the memoir ends.
Okay, there it's out.
Well, that's the first memoir. I was just reading Ruth Reichel's eighth
so excited.
Memoir. It's so good.
I'm sure she's unbelievable.
It's so good. All right, Becca, thank you so
honor,
much
Allie.
For
thank
coming.
For
it was such
me.
A pleasure. Of course, fun. I feel like I have a gazillion other questions, but
offline.
Yes, exactly.
Offline.
And Matt, thank you for being such a strong engineer. I love that.
Can we add wine and offline, please?
Yes.
Is it wine 30? It's almost 5.
It's almost 5. Next time on In the Sauce, I actually am going to split the time with Rachel, who's one of the founders of Seed and Mill Tahini, and she's going to interview me for half the time. Yeah, because I feel like people might need an update on what's going on with the sauce.
I like it.
So thanks for listening, and catch you later.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.